is to talk about. I mean, if that gospel, we could just sit down for days and kind of break it out line by line by line. And lots of things going. And I hope, again, I'll say this, just that the way biblical criticism has evolved over the years, I hope we can hear that there are many different textual levels, that there are the words of Jesus, and then there are probably later additions by the Christian community that reflect more the emerging Christian community than it did exactly at the time of Jesus. Like that line about, whoever acknowledges me before others, I will acknowledge in heaven. That sounds a lot like something going on in the early church as they began to be persecuted. And so much of this fracturing and division also, I'm sure, reflects the early church as this emergent Christianity was so divisive and so controversial within Judaism. And you doubtless had families split apart. And that's apart from the kind of psychological wisdom that we'll get to in a minute that has to do with how we have to separate from even our families of origin. So the real heart of what I want to talk about today is it has to do with both what Paul is saying as the old self being crucified, and Jesus saying, you know, if you try to find your life or hold on to your life, you will lose it. But if you understand what it means to go through that Christian process of transformation that we speak of as death and resurrection, you will find a different self. But what I would like to do, when Paul says something like this, we know that our old self was crucified with him so that the body of sin might be destroyed. I'm not sure every one of us here really identifies with a statement like that very much. And if you do think of yourself as a body of sin, then we have further conversations because the Christian tradition has accused us and has told us that we are evil. And Paul is not so much saying this. And that's what I hope to get to in a few minutes. First, just a couple of kind of textual questions. I hope we hear Jeremiah, who is sort of par excellence the prophet of the Old Testament that experienced most distinctly how hard it is to be the only voice that is willing to speak about a truth in a social situation where you are almost inescapably going to meet a lot of resistance. People who are really invested in the way things are don't like to have someone say, you know, the way things are is pretty much corrupt and needs to change at its root. Which was what Jeremiah was saying in those decades prior to the fall of Jerusalem in 587. I mean, he saw trouble on the horizon and nobody wanted to hear it. And in the same sense, Jesus also, I hope you heard that reference where if they have called the master of the house Beelzebul, can't quite remember what demon that was, but it might be Lord of the Flies, actually. If they call the master of the house Beelzebul, what will they do to his household? Well, that was Jesus reflecting on how they had been calling him a blasphemer, a godless man. Again, because Jesus was, well, they even take those words from Jeremiah, zeal for his house has eaten him up. They use those words to talk about Jesus, how there is a truth or a vision of what is actual and real that is not being honored. And so that fate of those who must speak the truth to a world that is not receptive and how violently the world often responds. So there's that. I want us to hear that line. Nothing that is secret will remain so, and everything that is now covered up will be made clear, will be brought out into the open. And I think this is addressing us at some of the level of both our deepest longing and our deepest fears. You know, we say that prayer, you know, God, unto whom all hearts are open, all desires known, and from whom no secrets are hid. But I'm not sure we, well, let me just say, I don't. live all the time in the full awareness of that radical transparency. And I often compare us in our interactions with each other. We're like the two-year-old child that puts his hands over his eyes and thinks thereby that he is hidden. You know, you can't see me. And I think we are like that a lot with each other. And we sort of agree with each other not really to notice what's going on, not to read as clearly as we might the expressions on our faces that might say clearer than we like to acknowledge, what's really going on with us and the kind of burdens that we bear. And we often, a part of our social reality is that we sort of ignore that. And when I say it's one of our deepest longings, that the sections from 1 Corinthians, we see through a glass darkly now, but then we shall know even as we are fully known. We don't like our hiding. We feel like it's necessary, but we all of us hide to some pretty significant degree, even from ourselves, which of course is the realm of sort of depth psychology. And how do we bring forth those things that are hidden within us so that we can be now in more conscious relation? So, just a line. Fear not the one who can destroy the body. Fear the one who can destroy the body and soul in hell. And many commentators point out there is an almost automatic jump to assume that what Jesus is talking about there is God. Fear God, who can destroy both your body and soul in hell. First of all, the hell that is referred to there is called Gehenna. And it's not anything like the Christian hell of eternal suffering. It's sort of a garbage dump outside of Jerusalem, but its name in Hebrew is the Valley of Ben Hinnom, which was known, I was going to say legendary, as a site of human and child sacrifice. So the Valley of Ben Hinnom is sort of associated with the most radical possible departure from that covenant with God. And especially when you hear something like destroy both body and soul in hell, is that how we're supposed to regard God? Is that what God wants to do to us, or is willing to do to us? And again, listen to the words that follow. Are not two sparrows sold for a penny, yet not one of them will fall to the ground apart from your Father, and even the hairs of your head are all counted. So do not be afraid. You are of more value than many sparrows. And nobody laughs when they hear Jesus. You need to laugh when you hear Jesus say that. Don't you understand that you're more valuable than some sparrows, and yet not one of them falls to the ground without God's participation, which is to say, all of creation exists within God, and the sparrow that falls to the ground within God, and so do we. And as Jesus said so often, you are safe beyond any capacity of yours to imagine. Don't be afraid. So I think what the real question that comes out of that is, what is it that does destroy our humanity, our body and soul? What causes us to lose our sense of being alive in this creation and our sense of personal agency and our sense of personal responsibility? How do we lose our way so that individually and collectively whole cultures go crazy and get sort of swept up in these big surges of energy where nobody really seems to be responsible anymore? I mean, we need to be kind of savvy about that, because we are fragile and vulnerable as creatures, and we go crazy on a regular basis. And then, just all the stuff that Jesus was talking about, family obligations. Again, there is a huge psychological field to be explored there, but one of the places to start is just to remember that the people of first century Palestine lived within a construct, a social construct, that put extraordinary value on family ties and family obligations, and your family obligations were paramount. And Jesus came into that and said, no, they're not. Your family obligations are not paramount. You know, I want to follow you, Jesus, but I've got to bury my father. Leave the dead to bury their dead. You come, you've got a higher responsibility. And, you know, Jesus was trying to break people loose from their sense of what their priorities were so that he could sort of open the space so that people could understand Jesus when he said, your highest priority is to experience the love of God and let that be what shapes your sense of yourself and the world and how you relate to the world. That's your highest priority. And if you let anything else get in the way, you're on the road to being lost. If you let your family obligations or what you believe to be your religious obligations, of course religion and God are not always in sync, or national obligations, whatever it is, nothing is of higher priority than the love of God. That's what you are. That's the single quest for us as human beings, within which everything else will make sense. The love of family, the love of country, the love of every other kind of love will make sense when that ultimate question is guiding things. So, you might think, I'm ready to quit at this point. But now I'm going to get to the real sermon. So, the sense that I've been living with this week, when Paul talks about the old self being crucified, the body of sin, or when Jesus says at the end of the gospel today, if you try to hang on to your life, you will lose it. But if you lose your life, then you have a possibility of finding it. And what struck me quite forcibly is that every person here today and every person on the planet has come to know who he or she is in relation to that which is not love. Our identities have been formed. Our picture of the world has been formed. How we understand our particular struggles, how we come to think of ourselves as worthy or unworthy, capable, lovable, everything about us, our entire human experience, has been shaped by that which is not love. And I don't want to say love is completely absent. That's the complexity of our human experience, is that love and that which is not love are woven together in very complex ways, and ways that are very difficult to sort of really understand and get conscious of. But every one of us has come to understand, you've all come to understand yourselves, as I have come to understand myself, in relation to something other than love. And the Christian, one of the most central Christian premises, I would say, is a human being only becomes, authentically emerges in relation to love. You only become who you really are if you are in conversation with love. And not an easy love, not a sentimental love or a love that just wants to pretend everything is all right, but that love that is both profoundly disclosing, like the brightest light any of us have ever known, and entirely love. Pure, pure, pure love. That simply is the truth about who we are. The truth about who we are that will only be disclosed by love. And so, when we talk about baptism, when Paul talks about the body of sin being crucified, what that refers to is everything that you've come to understand about yourself in dialogue or in conversation with something other than love. And it's happened in your families, and it's happened in your schools, and it's happened in your churches, and it happens in the meditations of your heart. We are formed by that which is not love. And as they say, sin begets sin. When you are formed by that which is not love, you become unloving or unlovely. again, that line, love to the loveless shown that they might lovely be. We are all formed by that which is not love. And then in the world, when we talk about the world can be understood. I mean, I've been laboring to describe this for years, but I may come up now with the simplest description of all. When Paul or any of the writers of the New Testament speak about the world, they're talking about the realm where power is exercised without love. And again, behold the play of social energy and people's agendas and nations' agendas, and the world's energy moves in so many instances without any love or concern for the well-being of the whole. The world, in theological terms, the world with quotes around it, as a theological domain, is that sphere where power is exercised without love. And in the personal sphere, we have been formed by things by which we feel judged, condemned, frightened, coerced, manipulated. And again, remember that even that which seems to be love is often not. Think of the phenomenon of codependence that we've been talking about for a few decades now, where, you know, that used to be thought of as love. It didn't feel like love, but it was described as love. And really, it was a fairly toxic kind of entanglement where, for my needs to be met, I need you to be in a particular way so that I can feel a certain way about myself. That's something that seems like love, but it's not love, and yet it shapes us. And so when Jesus says, if you try to hold on to your life, you will lose it, what he's referring to, I'm quite clear, is that sense of yourself that has been formed by something other than love. And you think that's who you are. We all do. I mean, it is a very deep conviction. That's who I am. And that's why the imagery is so radical. You've got to die to that self. You've got to die to the self that you have come to believe you are, because that self was formed without love. And then the new life, the risen, what's described as the risen life, is a life that is, you at last are going to begin your emergence, your true development and growth in response to love. And you make that known. And that's the Christian life. Come to know the love of God and let yourself come to be in response to that, and then bring it forth into the world so that the world itself can be, that's the amazing, the world itself can be overcome. The world with its lack of love and its aggression and its self-interest and its lies, everything, it will all be made clear, and you will walk with confidence being able to love that which formerly had been, in a sense, dominating you and mastering you and telling you who you are. That which is not love will lose its power to tell you who you are. And when you feel those temptations to feel insecure or, wow, I need that to be a real person, another voice will rise up and say, oh, no, you don't. You are whole and complete just as you are. And though your life may contain many things that you need to change and ways you need to grow, the starting point is that you are loved beyond any possible imagining. That's the starting point. That's not where we find ourselves in midlife. We find ourselves kind of anxious and kind of concerned and wondering whether we can ever get back on the real path. And the path involves letting go of the self we have come to believe we are, so that we might rediscover who we really are.